This is When Spirit Calls, and you on your journey are in the right place. This show is about magic, miracles, and meaning shared through stories, interviews, and channeled messages. We have so much to share about who you are and your divine mission here on the earth. Let's get to it. When Spirit Calls is right now.
We've got another inspirational guest for you on today's show. Today, our guest is Greg Gurman. And let me tell you, this guy has a story that's going to blow your mind. I don't think his bio quite gives him justice, but I hope that you stay tuned because this is a story that you are going to want to hear. Greg is the founder of Lifecraft. Through Lifecraft, Greg leads soul healing experiences that awaken what is most real and alive within us. His work is rooted in a simple radical truth. Soul embodiment is not about transcendence. It's about becoming deeply, fiercely human. It's about reclaiming the parts we've hidden, forgotten, or exiled, and learning to walk with them in love. I hope you get so much out of today's episode. It's a powerful story of how we can come back to ourselves with love. Hey, everyone. It's another edition of When Spirit Calls. I am so happy to be with you, and I am extra excited about our guest today. I had the privilege of meeting this beautiful human about over a month ago now. And, you know, this guy was just something else. He had a light about him that I hadn't seen in another human for a really long time. And I am so privileged and honored to have him as our guest today because he has got a story to tell you and some wisdom, not just from that story, but from some of his past life experiences, which I will let him kind of dive in and share with you about. So, Greg, I'm so happy you're here.
Thank you. Wow, what a humbling introduction. I appreciate you.
Oh, well, you know, I think you're such a gift to the world and, you know, you have such a visionary mind. And I'll be honest, you know, you reminded me of parts of myself. You know, in some of those visionary pieces and this idea to help reshape how we live, how we show up in the world, how we human. And so I feel like it's such a privilege for me, truly. So I'm going to get you going on the story because you have a really incredible story that I know just a little bit about. And I think there's some real potency and some real medicine in your experience and in your story. So we're going to start off with that. That opportunity when spirit was calling you, whether you knew it or not at the time. And I'm going to invite you to kind of start back at the beginning for us.
Sure. Yeah. Thanks, Dee. So for anyone that's watching this, there's a sign behind me that says be fully human. And this story is really the story of how I came to understand what it means to be a full human being and our pursuit of pathways to guide others into this fully human life, which is the most fulfilling, abundant, meaningful, fully expressed human experience. And it's our birthright. It's available to us all. So the beginning of the story, we can go all the way back to when I was just a little kid. And from a very early age, when we first begin to create our self-identity, without realizing that we're doing so, of course, we all do this. I took on the identity of an achiever. I noticed that when I appeared smarter than or did things faster than, learned better than my peers, my siblings, my parents, my teachers, my coaches, all very happy, very proud. And without realizing it, I took on some deep beliefs about my enoughness, my lovability, my belonging, being contingent on what I produce, what I create, how I make others proud.
I feel that. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you know, Dee, in our Western material world, that can drive us to excel, right? If you're going to take on an untrue unconscious belief, it's not a bad one if you're trying to accumulate stuff, right?
Sure, that's kind of how I felt about it for a long time. Yeah.
Sure. And so this drove me to excel in my life. I was a very, very driven child. And what appeared outwardly, like you know, I'm really succeeding at life. Inwardly, there was a desperation, and there was it was never enough. No matter if I was the best person on the team, which I was always driving at, if I was the smartest in the class, which I was always driving at, if in you know fill in the blank, I still felt not enough, and so that drove me through school and into university, and I always wanted to be a doctor from a young age. And in fact, all of my family and friends, everybody knew that was what I was going to do. That was my path. And it very much became a part of my identity too. And so I went straight into a medical program, an honors degree in faculty medicine at the U of A, with plans of heading into psychiatry. And by the end of that first degree, I had succeeded outwardly in a lot of ways. You know, I had become the president of the faculty for 2 years. I was a varsity sprinter at the U of A and then was recruited by Team Canada bobsleigh. And I had started several businesses. I was coaching teams. The businesses were going very well. So I was donating money and really trying to build my resume as a pillar in the community, this notorious doctor. And at that time in my life, I had a lot of expensive stuff, shiny things. And if you would have asked me if I was happy, I would have said, well, of course I'm happy. Look at all my shiny things. You know, look at my 8,000 Facebook friends, and I can go and do anything I want to do, and I can buy this and have that. And I would have thought I was telling the truth. You know, I was so in denial that the deeper truths of what my soul was calling me toward were not being heard. I couldn't even hold them. And so towards the end of that degree, I started to experience a failure of my paradigm. My paradigm was, sure, you don't feel enough yet, but that's because you haven't reached your full potential. You just need more, you know, another $1 million, another World Cup gold medal, another blank. And you know, I think the reason that we see a lot of suicide among rock stars, movie stars, dentists is because they've actually achieved the things that they promised themselves would bring them happiness, yeah. And it hasn't.
Yes.
And sometimes when you reach that place, you have nowhere to go.
Right.
Right. If all this stuff that society and everyone's been telling me is going to bring me happiness has not brought me happiness. And if I can no longer believe that the next record, the next movie, the next $1 million is going to bring me happiness, where do you go from there? You really can only conclude that you're incapable of it.
Right? Yeah. I call that the I'll be happy when game.
Yeah.
I'll be happy when. I'll be happy when I finish the degree. I'll be happy when I get the award. I'll be happy when. Right?
Exactly right.
It's a losing game, as you know.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I found myself there.
Wow.
And so my behavior started to become erratic. You know, I was throwing Hail Marys, buying big things, buying big trips, and doing crazy stuff.
Yeah.
50% of that was me throwing a Hail Mary, trying to pedestalize the next thing and hoping that this next thing is somehow going to give me what all these other things have not.
Yeah.
And 50% was a fuck it to the universe.
Right.
I was
like all this and I'm still not happy. Fuck it. Yeah.
You know, I was 21, and I had a lot more money than I had character at this time. And so I was spending money erratically, kind of going, well, I'll do whatever I want. You know, I started to develop a petulance and I started to feel like I was entitled somehow, like from the earliest ages. I was the hardest working person that I knew, the most dedicated, never touched any drugs, never got into anything that couldn't be reconciled with the life of optimal performance.
Right.
And so I felt like I had given up so much to race ahead and create a life that I thought was going to make me happy. And I felt like all that effort was for nothing.
Mm.
And I also felt very alone because as I started to realize how empty my life was, I had no one to connect with on that. You know, all my friends thought I was doing all the things that we're all trying to do. And if I would have looked at my friends and said, hey, guys, I kind of hate my life, they would have looked at me like I was an alien, you know?
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And I knew that. And I was looking at myself as an alien a little bit too. Like I couldn't quite acknowledge where I was really at.
Yeah.
And so I'll backtrack a little bit here, Dee. At the start of that degree, so 4 years before this, I was only 17. And so I got snuck into this bar for this birthday party. And some of the people that I knew on the track team, they had friends and relatives that were at this party. And some of these people were from really wealthy families in the area, involved in a lot of businesses. And these guys were a few years older than me, 18, 19, 20. They were cousins and they were starting to take over some of the family businesses. Mm-hmm. And they were also getting into some illegal stuff. Mm-hmm. They were buying drugs like cocaine in Mexico and the southern US and bringing it up into Canada and then wholesale selling it off. And they found out I was in pharmacology, which is like drug research, drug design. That was the degree I was doing in medicine. And they asked me if I would chemically test their cocaine for purity. And I was shocked. Like I had just met these guys. You know, I didn't even know anyone who sold weed. And now these guys are telling me about this, what sounds like a pretty sizable operation. I don't know anything about it, but, you know, like my toes curled up in my shoes and I'm going, oh my God. So I kind of, oh, it's, you know, I'm not really into that. You know, I don't know, wouldn't really be able to do that. And nudging people, hopefully someone changed the subject here, you know? Yeah, I couldn't believe how cavalier they were. Just met them and they're like, hey, well, why don't you test our kilograms of cocaine, you know? And yeah, I thought I was going to get shot in the parking lot that day. But of course, that didn't happen. And then over the course of that degree, as I was going through this progressive moral de-evolution, as I was trying to answer an inward call outwardly.
Yeah.
And losing touch with what's real, losing the experience of meaning in everything. And so becoming weaker, more lost, more rageful, but with a depressive rage I couldn't understand. All throughout those years, I would run into these guys randomly here and there. You know, I'd bump into them on campus or at a party or public places. And every time I did, they kept offering me more and more and more. So I could see their operation was growing. But it was always an instant automatic no for me. Like it wouldn't have, they could have offered me a bajillion, gajillion dollars. It wouldn't have mattered because I just couldn't begin to reconcile how me and this identity that was keeping me safe as this achiever and this successful pillar in the community, how I could reconcile that with this activity. I couldn't go there, couldn't get there. So kept saying no. And now fast forward to the end of that degree. And now one of the companies I started was a little trucking company. And we started out with just one truck and then expanded to more and then started bringing things in from the Port of Vancouver into Alberta and distributing. And then we made a big move to the US, bringing things up the seaboard in both directions and then in to Alberta.
Wow.
So I had to move to LA for a few months to get some stuff set up. And these guys found out I was moving there. And so they came with a big offer. They said, hey, if you can test this stuff for us down there, it's worth way more to us than testing it in Canada, because if we get it across the border into Canada and then discover that it's no good, you know, it's not easy to return it, I'm guessing.
Uh-huh.
And so they offered me a large amount of money, but it wasn't really about the money. You know, I was already making a lot of money. I was already spending a lot of money. And realistically, I was well beyond that income point where more money, it really doesn't change anything.
Yeah.
You know, there's no material shift in how you feel. Not that spending money ever has to do with happiness, really.
Fair.
But, you know, I was on tilt and I was kind of like this fuck it attitude. At that point in my life, I was feeling really weak and really destabilized, really disconnected, but in ways I couldn't understand at that age.
Yeah.
And I remember vividly, Dee, for the first time, allowing myself to consider it. They propositioned and I went, well, maybe I will, you know, fuck it. I'll do what I want. You know, I'm a man as this young boy. And as soon as I did that, I had this rush of emotion. I had become so numb in my life that my relationships had become sterile. I was so fixated on pursuing outward gain.
Yeah.
And there was a connection, a truth inside of me trying to call me home, that I was misinterpreting that call as a call for another boat or more carbon stuff, more mm-hmm. expensive this, you know? And so when I allowed myself to consider this, it was so intense, it was so mysterious and dangerous and so out of character for me that it pierced the fog that had formed around my heart.
Right. Wow.
And I remember feeling a charge. I remember feeling an emotion.
Yeah.
And, you know, so in a strange way, this kind of made me feel like a human being again.
Yeah, like I feel like there's an aliveness that came in you, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
Wow. Indeed.
Wow. And so now I can feel my deep nervous system, whose only job is to keep me safe, orienting towards this. I can feel it leaning into this. And my conscious mind, my ego brain is going, no, this is the worst idea you've ever had. Don't do this. And I remember not caring. I remember hearing that narrative so clearly in my head and going, fuck off.
Yeah.
It was like the primitive part of my human meat suit that is here to keep me safe. It somehow had determined, wrongly, but had determined that what I'd been chasing all my life, this sense of peace, enoughness, grounded meaning in my life, somehow it was here, right? This was the next pedestal.
Wow.
And so I agreed. And so they gave me this encrypted phone. And actually, a couple more things I'll share, Dee. I've learned that you can talk yourself into anything if you really believe it's what you need.
It's true.
And experiencing that myself has given me so much compassion for the people that we help now. And I remember thinking to myself, well, I've been watching these guys for 4 or 5 years, and right. I've been saying no all this time, and their operation's been growing. So I'm preventing nothing. They don't have anyone else who can do this. Nobody else has this esoteric knowledge on how to test these alkaloids. And so by me saying no, I'm preventing nothing. And if I say yes, now I can keep bad stuff out of Canada. You know, we didn't have fentanyl yet by this point, but there was other things they were cutting it with and buffing it with, and they're nuts. So now I'm thinking, I'm a public servant. You're welcome, right? This is how we can rationalize things. And, you know, the people who are involved in this are not who I thought. I think not who most people think. You know, I was expecting it to be people with leather vests and teardrop tattoos, and it is not. It's some of the highest professionals and politicians in our country, I think in all countries, who are involved in this. And so it was easy for me to romance the idea that there's no victims here. These are not street drugs. These are for wealthy people that want to party on the weekends, and there's no victims, which is also probably not true. Mm. So they give me this phone, and I take it down there with me when I move down there and just leave it plugged into the wall. And one day the phone rings, and I go and I meet this guy outside of LA. And he had 6 little pieces of cocaine. I didn't know it looked like that. I didn't know anything about it, mm-hmm. except the chemistry. And so I did, these are just little pieces, size of a thumbnail, less than a gram each. And so I did these little chemical reactions and weighed the precipitates to get a purity number. And then I left. Heart pounding the whole time.
Huh.
And so now I'm driving back to my apartment in LA, and I start to feel this panic come over me. It was like the dam of denial that I'd built, it broke.
Yeah.
And the truth of how quickly my life had taken a left-hand turn, and the truth of what I'd just done, it just crushed me. And I remember feeling like there was a black hole crushing my chest, the palm trees getting blurry. And I was overcome with the most intense rage I've ever experienced.
Mm.
And it was like, I knew I was powerful enough to do a lot of stuff in the 3D. And yet, in the only way I cared about it anymore, I felt completely neutered. And that was a lot for my ego. Yeah. And it was a lot for my critter brain, my survivor brain, because it felt out of power. It felt like safety was not available. And so I just wanted to quit everything. I was like, I feel like I've won the game of being a human being in the 3D level, and I fucking hate it. And what's the point of this? Like, why are we here? Why are we here trying to have more than the next person, sacrificing our health and our peace to buy stuff? Like, what's the point of all this? And I wanted to buy an island and never see another human being again. That's where I was. And so I wanted to quit my participation in this stuff too. That was no exception. So I called the people I knew back in Canada and I said, hey guys, like, here are your pretty numbers and I'm out. I'm not doing this anymore. And by then I knew, like, I had enough rapport with these guys. I knew I could just walk away. Yeah, so I did. So I finished what I had to do down there and I came home. And I kind of tried to manufacture my own come to Jesus rock bottom moment where I was hearing a whisper, just starting to hear a whisper in the back of my head that there's more to being a man, there's more to being a human being than just achieving, winning, having more. And so I endeavored to figure out what that was. And so I tried meditation, really got into meditation. I bought all the books. And the books I really wanted were the books that said the 5 steps to enlightenment, because I'm thinking, well, I'll just do this faster than you guys, you know, enlightened next, right?
Yeah.
And of course, that's not something that can be power steered, right? And so I abandoned that. And then I tried yoga for a while and I just hated it. It was so uncomfortable for me to try to move slowly and just be in this room for 45 minutes, moving slowly and breathing. I was like, I could have built a course by now. You know, like I couldn't sit there easily.
Yeah.
And so I kind of gave up on trying to figure out what the point of it was. And I fell back into this raging materialistic river that I had created my life to be. And on the surface, it was not uncomfortable. Like at a deep level, it was very uncomfortable. I couldn't be quiet. I couldn't be still. As long as I was running at 1,000 miles an hour, buying fancy shit and doing fancy shit, I could keep outrunning the truth that was stalking me. And so that's what I did. And 8 months later, I had one trip planned back to the US to gladhand some of our bigger clients. And so the plane lands. This is in Las Vegas. Plane lands there and I turn on my phone and my phone's going bing, 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 bing. And I vividly remember sitting in that plane thinking like, oh, yeah, I'm so important. Look at all the deals I'm doing. Look at all the money I'm moving. Look at all the things. And after a few minutes, I noticed that people who had stood up to get their stuff out of the overhead bins are all sitting back down again. And I look out the window and I can see Vegas, like I can see the desert, but we're not at the airport. We're not pulled up to the terminal. But I think, well, whatever. We must have a long taxi. Fine. I got stuff to do. So back I am here and plane's not moving. And then 4 police cars surround the plane on the runway there with their lights on. And I'm still not thinking anything. You know, that this stuff that I had done, it was 8 months ago, which at that age in my life with how fast I was moving, that was a lifetime ago.
Totally.
And I had totally washed my hands of it, cut all ties. I never spoke to those guys again. I never accepted any money.
You're done. Yeah.
I felt gross about it. So I just like walked away. I was like, thank God I didn't get caught. And I'm just going to walk away from that. And then I was actively denying it, right? To myself, I'm saying, well, I never did that. You know, I'm not a dirtbag.
Yeah.
So now police cars are surrounded the plane. I'm really not thinking anything for me. And I start making jokes. Like, I knew some people on the plane and I'm like, oh, who's a terrorist? You know? And then I'm back in my phone and I feel this shadow come over me in the aisle. And it's this like 7 foot tall shaved head DEA vest. And he says, are you Greg Gurman? And I'm still not thinking anything deep. So I'm like, yeah, like, how can I help you? You know, what can I help you with? And whew, he snatched me up and my feet didn't touch the carpet all the way off the plane, hauled me off the plane, ran me down these rickety steps tackle me down on this runway and then handcuff me behind my back and then put me in the back of this black FBI car that was kind of parked under the wing now. So of course, now I know exactly what this is, right? This is the only illegal thing I've ever done in my life. And after what felt like an eternity, this FBI agent gets in the back seat beside me and he says, "Do you know what this is about?" And I lie, right? I'm going, "What? No. Like, the hell is this? What's going on here?"
Yeah.
And he said, "Shut the fuck up." And he put his BlackBerry in front of my face. So I'm sitting there in this chair, in this seat in the back of this car, and he starts scrolling through pictures. So the person who I had met to chemically test this stuff for in Southern California, he had just before that been arrested crossing the border, and he had flipped.
Yeah.
So I found out in my discovery that when I went back to Canada, I was under very high-level surveillance. They had the rotating vans outside my house, 24/7, 365, with two agents in it. I was being followed everywhere, to school, to work, to my businesses. And they found nothing, right? No money coming in, no contact with any of these people. So they just kept watching me. But the U.S. is a little bit different. They want their pound of flesh. It's a very, very different system down there. Yeah. Yeah, so they take me to the FBI headquarters in Las Vegas.
Wow.
And yeah, it's just like you see in the movies, really. Like I'm in.
That's what I'm thinking. I'm like, I feel like I'm hearing a movie here.
Yeah. Wow. Sure. Yeah. So I'm in this little interrogation room, and they got the little wooden table with the ring in the middle, and my handcuffs are through the ring. And it's two-way glass. So they got agents on the other side. And this is a joint investigation between the RCMP in Canada and then the DEA and the FBI in the U.S. And so these American agents are out on the phone with the RCMP detectives and then back in rotating agents. And they're bringing in pictures of people, places. What do you know about this person? Who's this? Where's this? You know, this kind of thing. And the confidential informant, I found out later, had told them exactly what I knew.
Mm.
You know, I'd been watching these guys for years, and we had a lot of common friends. And then when I finally agreed to do this, I became a part of that world, and I became privy to where everything was and where it was going and who was doing what and all that.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to make some quick decisions.
Mm-hmm. Well,
yeah, you learn a lot about yourself in these situations. So they presented me with my indictments, and I was shocked. You know, a minute ago I was saying how different it is than the Canadian system. In my head, I was thinking about the Canadian system. I'm thinking, okay, I did a chemical reaction on a few little pieces of something.
Yeah.
An amount where if you got caught with it in your pocket, probably nothing would happen. And I wasn't buying it, selling it, transporting it.
None of that.
In chemical reaction. So I'm thinking, oh, I'm going to get community service maybe or something like that.
Get your hand slapped, yeah.
Right. Well, in the U.S., they have these RICO statutes. They're conspiracy laws that are designed to, or allegedly designed to catch, you know, like high-level mafia bosses who are many degrees of separation away from the actual crime.
Yeah.
And the way those work is, if they can connect you to someone, you become a part of the conspiracy. And then the sum total of the conspiracy is charged to everyone that's been connected.
Wow.
So I was being charged with 1,800 kilograms of cocaine and 1 million ecstasy pills, 1,000 pounds of weed, a bunch of guns.
Whoa.
Yeah. And so my mandatory minimum was 10 years to maximum life.
Whoa.
And I'm finding out in real time that in the federal system in the U.S., life means your life. There's no parole.
Whoa.
And 10 years means 10 years. There's no parole.
Whoa.
So now I'm going, what? Like, I'm in my early 20s, and you're telling me I'm going to spend all my 20s, best case scenario.
Yes. Freaking,
right? Whoa. And then they say, but hey, you don't have to go down for this. They said, we had a confidential informant involved before you and after you. We know that you had only this one point of contact. We know you didn't accept any money for this. They said, you don't have to go down for this. They said, here's what we're going to do. We're going to take away your passport. you go about your trip here in the U.S. They knew all about it, right? Their intelligence is extraordinary.
Wow.
And they said, when you fly back to Edmonton, there'll be a handler somewhere on the plane. You won't know who it is. When you land in Edmonton, you will be assigned an RCMP handler, and you will continue to meet with the people you know and then liaise with this RCMP handler.
Whoa.
Basically, and become a spy
for them. Yeah.
Wow.
Well, yeah, they're like a confidential informant, basically.
I guess.
Yeah. I don't think I was about to get a... I don't think I was going to get a handgun and a badge or anything.
Fair enough.
Yeah. And this is common, right? This is pretty much anybody in my situation is going to have this type of an offer because they're trying to expand their investigation. The truth is they really don't give a fuck about me. I'm just some student athlete who did something on an afternoon, right? They don't really care about me, but they want to use me to get to...
Yeah.
So they said, if you do this, then no charges. Nobody will ever know about this. And actually, they offered me quite a bit of money, a couple $100,000, because they're trying to flip you quickly. Once you get involved in things like this, you're always being watched. And if you fly somewhere and you disappear for 10 hours, 12 hours, now you're burnt. And now your life's in danger and they're responsible for that.
Yeah.
So they're trying to flip you really quickly.
Yeah.
And... yeah, so like I said, I had to make some tough decisions. And at that time in my life, I felt so empty, so hollow. I felt like such a failure. I had this wicked imposter syndrome where I had achieved so much, but none of it was me. None of it, I couldn't connect to any of it. Yeah. And I felt so alone and worthless. And the only thing keeping me safe was my identity.
Wow. You know,
the ego. Everybody saw me as this guy.
Yeah.
That was my shield that... I thought was keeping people from seeing the truth of how pathetic I was. And so in this situation, I would have thought that I would have done anything to keep people from finding out what I'd done. My one mistake, my biggest shame. You know?
Yeah.
And yet sitting there in that interrogation room, I had this wash of grace come over me. And for the first time, I was ready to really acknowledge that I didn't have the tools to save my own life.
Wow.
I was ready to acknowledge that I knew I needed the rug pulled out from under me while I was still standing on it, and that I wouldn't step off.
Yeah.
And I had, after months and months of trying to figure out what the point of it all is, I had come to the realization that I didn't have the strength or the character or the integrity or the tools to rescue myself from this raging river of materialism that was dragging me. And, you know, in my life, I didn't want to keep achieving. I didn't want to keep running. But as soon as I stopped, I felt this crushing existential dread, fear, not enoughness. Yeah. So I had to keep achieving, achieving, achieving. And as I'm achieving, I can feel myself running out into the abyss.
Yeah.
I can feel my connection to heart, although I wouldn't have been able to articulate that. I can feel it dying. But I can't stop. And so in that moment of grace, it occurred to me that maybe the reset I had been begging for was this.
Wow.
And so in that moment of grace, I decided that I just couldn't remember anyone's name. And I just really didn't know much about anything at all. And they really don't like that. And they're not used to it because they will take your life away. And so... almost everybody talks down there.
Right.
So they were like, wow, this kid's going to sing. You know, he's got so much ahead of him.
Totally. History,
I mean, nobody knows him.
Like hook, line, and sinker, you know? Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So I decided I couldn't remember his name. And then all the good cops disappeared and my coffee disappeared very quickly. And before I know it, I'm leg chains, belly chains, all chained up in the back of this unmarked Suburban.
Wow.
Inside a cage, speeding off to jail. And now my moment of grace has passed, and now I'm going, hey, I'll tell you guys anything. Like, I was just kidding before, you know, I'll tell you anything. But luckily for my soul, that window was closed. Those agents didn't even flinch. They got an earpiece in, sunglasses on, head forward, They don't give a fuck about me at all. So off we go. And so I ended up being sentenced to 92 months, 7 years, 8 months. And the reason I got below the 10-year minimum is through some legal nuance that my lawyer worked out, because I was nonviolent first time offender and I had a bunch of letters of support from community members. So 7 years, 8 months was my sentence. And yeah, I started in the max, because when you're from Canada, they consider you a flight risk.
Whoa.
And so a couple things I want to share about this piece to kind of bring everything home.
Yeah.
Those first 2 weeks in prison, D, were massively existentially painful. Oh. The media was really hard on me, and they sensationalized things. So it was like, you know, pharmacist selling drugs. I was a volunteer on the addictions hotline and the suicide hotline. Okay. And so this headlines, this is true. They were saying pharmacist. I was a pharmacology undergrad.
Yeah.
Yeah. They said pharmacist is selling drugs to addicts on the addictions hotline.
Oh,
and,
wow.
And just kind of crazy stuff. For a while there, my name was Gary in the news. So by the time COVID came around, I was very well acquainted with the fast and loose nature of media and how it's used as a tool by the powers that be. And it's not a reflection of what's really going on. But because I didn't tell, I was positioned as the kingpin because they had no one else.
That's right.
So I was positioned as this like $270 million drug bust.
Look at what they got. Yeah. Oh my God. It's such a sham. Oh
yeah. So that was really hard on me because my identity was so important to me.
Oh, the ego gets a complete death in that experience, you know, right?
It was an aggressive evacuation. And so,
go ahead.
Yeah. So every morning I'd wake up and open my eyes and bars and like, no, this isn't right. And close my eyes and open them again. And of course it was. And for those 2 weeks, I was like floating around in prison. I was nothing. I was nobody. The entire interface with which I used to communicate with the outside world was gone. And yeah, it was like I was a shell of pain. I felt like I didn't have a name. I felt like I was nothing.
Wow.
And then after about 2 weeks of that, this incredible, beautiful wave of love, deep grounded peace washed over me.
Wow.
And I remember thinking, what the hell is this? You know, I'm walking around in prison and I just feel this profound love for myself and for all the guys in there. Every moment is a sweet nectar. And I just feel so present in my body. I had this unshakable conviction that everything was going to be perfectly perfect, even though I had no evidence of that whatsoever, hadn't been sentenced yet or anything.
Wow.
And I didn't want to be in that place without it, so I didn't want to ask any questions. So I was just kind of like letting it be. And so I cruised around for months in this jail, eating rotten potato stew and fighting violence constantly, crusty cum stains on my sheets, my clothes, because they don't do laundry there very well. And yet just like so free, so in love. And then that feeling started to fade. Mm. And I tried to hold on to it, but I didn't know what I was trying to hold on to.
Yeah.
And it seemed like the harder I squeezed, the faster it faded. And remarkably, in a very short period of time, days, I was back to feeling like a complete loser. And I hope my family forgets about me. I almost made them proud, but I fucked it all up.
Wow.
And feeling very unsafe in there, very disempowered, very vulnerable. Mm. And it took me the next three and a half years in prison, D, to figure out what that was.
Wow.
And it was this. From that early age, when I developed that identity as an achiever, as a producer, I created an image of myself that I thought was lovable and enough. And that turned out to be this doctor who's this winner in every way. And every single thing I did in my life was for and through that self-created identity. And when you live your life this way, a couple things happen. One is that you can drain your batteries, but you can never fill them. You can pour energy into creating and manifesting and doing stuff for this fictional identity. But I've come to understand that human beings, we experience meaning to the degree to which we are in loving service of our soulful truth.
Ooh, wait, I want you to say that again because it was profound.
Yeah, so I think that we experience meaning and connection to the degree to which we are in loving service through our soulful gifts.
Love.
And so when we achieve for an identity, it would be like if you and I swapped goals lists. You might achieve everything on my list and then get to the end of that and go, meh, you know, right? And that's because your beautiful, perfect, unique soul is here with an incredible constellation of gifts and skills and passions and experience in your life and past lives, and all of those things intersect at this place of beautiful balance and power where you can move energy completely undistorted through your system in loving service. You can channel abundance and life force into the world. And the way that we are organized as beings, that fully human state is the most joyful, connected, abundant, fulfilling, meaningful experience of life. And it's calling us all the time.
Yeah, sure is.
And when you achieve for an identity, you preclude yourself of the beauty of expressing your truth, bravely expressing your truth in the world, and then experiencing the fully human life from that. And another thing that happens, Dee, is that you can't ever be in the moment, right? When we live through an identity, when an identity is our interface for everything and everyone, we can't be an authentic expression, authentic connection. We can't be in the moment with somebody. When someone says or does something, instead of us responding authentically, we have to pause and run it through the algorithm. What does my identity say and do and think about this?
Oh, yes.
And then we formulate our response and then we say, hey, check this out. I need you to understand that this is how I choose to be perceived on this issue, right? Yeah. And in doing so, we're never in the moment, which is the magic, right? That's the truth of the human experience. And so I could see that at a young age, I had low batteries because I was drive to create things that meant nothing and deprive myself of the simple bliss of being in the moment. Mm. And in jail, that ego, that identity, that had become so heavy. You know, it went from being something that I aspired to create and that I thought was going to keep me safe, yeah, to over a period of years, it becomes this massively heavy thing that you have to affirm now.
Yeah. And you have to maintain or
right.
Hurt. Yeah.
Right. And I very much felt that I was to a point where if I wasn't the wealthiest, most successful, most loved person in the room, I felt like I was nothing.
Right. Yeah. Wow.
And so my arrest was a complete dissolution of that ego and that identity. And I was kicking and screaming. I would have given my right arm to keep people from finding out what I'd really done.
Of course.
Resisting the most beautiful gift that I had manifested for myself. And so that peace that I felt in jail was the peace of just being me. I didn't even know what the hell that was. What do you mean, just me? Who's that?
Yeah. Right. Stripping all the other stuff away.
Right.
Wow.
Yeah. Just being free, present in the moment. And it was the most restful, beautiful, blissful experience of truth. Mm. It's our natural state. It's our innate and inherent place that we fall from when we allow ourselves to be programmed and take on traumas and self-limiting beliefs, all illusion, right?
Yeah. All illusion.
But all illusion with a purpose that's meant to guide us home.
Right.
Yeah. And so I felt that peace, and then that peace began to fade because I didn't realize, I couldn't conceptualize the gift I'd been given. And after a few months of being nothing and no one, I started to think, well, you know what? I'm going to rise from these ashes. Yeah, that's what I'm going to do. And I'm going to do this in my life. I'm going to be this guy. And I'm going to write this book and whatever. And I'm beginning to manufacture a new identity.
Yeah.
And as soon as I started living through that identity, I experienced a loss of freedom and love, which is scary and I hate it. And what do? When I'm feeling afraid, I grab on harder to an identity that I think I still haven't figured out, right? What's going on here?
Yeah.
And so the harder I grabbed onto that, the more I'm walking around in jail like, hey, brother, check this out. Know this about me. This is who I am, right? And trying to be safe in the 3D world. And meanwhile, stepping away from my heart again, from my soul. Mm-hmm. And so it took me years in prison to figure out how that went. And so now fast forward, by the time I came home, I felt so free. People tease me all the time that I went to prison to get free, and it's very true.
I think it's actually brilliant, and I love the whole concept of the fact that jail was your call back to your soul, that jail was what brought you back to yourself and to your truth. I find that so fascinating. You know, what we might perceive as being the worst thing ever, or one of the worst things, was the most brilliant gift for you.
Sure. Yeah. So when I came home, you know, I went from being worth $5.5 million to moving into my parents' basement at 29. I was just a couple weeks away from 23.
Humility. Yeah.
With nothing. Everything was gone. And yet I was so free, you know, no ego at all.
Yeah.
And it was just striking me how so many people in my life, I could see them on that hedonistic treadmill that we talked about before, where they were feeling a call from inside, feeling their soul calling them home, and misinterpreting that as a need for a better job, you know, bigger body parts, smaller body parts, whatever.
Whatever it is. Yeah.
And so my future as a physician was not a straight path from there, because now I have a narcotics felony, right? It sounds crazy. When I feel like I'm talking about somebody else when I say
that. I know that. Yeah. It's wild.
Right? Yeah. But I still felt this profound call to heal. I felt like there was something in my codes that was going to allow me to guide people to true healing. I had no idea what that was or where to begin, but I committed to surrender. And I've now been home for just over 10 years. And in those 10 years has manifest everything that we have at LifeCraft and the community that we're building. These beautiful, unique forms of healthcare that are true soul level healing. And yeah, so I'm a grateful guy. I'm grateful anytime I get a chance to share. I know that's a long story.
I loved it. I was invested fully the whole time. And I find it so fascinating. The grace and the humility in which you speak about it is something to witness in itself.
Mm.
So thank you for sharing with that level of connection. You shared a few golden nuggets that you've learned along the way in some pretty profound messages. But if you could tell the world something that you just wish that we all knew, what would that something be?
What a beautiful question. Okay, I've got one. I've had the distinct pleasure of guiding thousands of people into states of deep trance where we get to commune with their soul. I've had the pleasure of guiding about 450 people on big psychedelic journeys where we do much of the same at a very high level. And so in that work, I've seen over and over and over again the truth of the human soul. And what I would bet everything on is the truth that you are perfection. Your natural state, and by you I mean everyone who could ever listen to this, your natural state is profound and perfect peace, bliss, love, unfuckwithability, freedom. That is the truth of who you are. And any experience other than that is a loving gift that your soul raised its hand for before you pumped into this body.
Yeah.
To illuminate where you have forgotten the beauty and fullness of who you are.
Yes. Oh, brilliant. Brilliant. I love it. Because I think we forget that the joy and the bliss and the love is innately given. It's innately given. It is us. And everything outside of that is the cloud, is the illusion, is the, like you said, the raising of the hand to say, hey, you're not free here, or you've forgotten who you are, the truth of who you are. Oh, okay, well, we could talk all day, but we are going to come to a close here, because I think that there's enough in that story for us to really sit with. And I invite our audience, our listeners today, to really think about their own identities and how hooked into their identities. Because as you were speaking that, I'm thinking like, oh, wait a second. Maybe I am still hooked into some of my identity in a really big way. And how can I allow myself to be more free of that? And I know that I'm moving into a really big, massive phase of my true authenticity right now and moving through a lot of discomfort in that, in the letting go of. And so it really spoke to me today in really thinking about how hooked in I am into my own identity and how much that actually is holding me hostage right now.
Right.
And so again, back to the invitation of our listeners today is to think about your own identities or identity, however you perceive that. And I feel like I have multiple identities that I've hooked into, right? And to start peeling back the layers of that and recognizing that you're none of those things in the truth of it, right? You are a spiritual being that's having this human experience. And if we can allow ourselves to understand it from that perspective, it kind of starts to take away some of that egoic hook into identity and how we think everyone thinks we need to be and, you know, how we feel we need to be perceived in the world too. Because that's ultimate freedom when we stop worrying about what everyone else thinks. Right? Isn't that an ultimate freedom? Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, we better wrap this up for today. Any final words before we direct people to where they can go to find you? Anything else that is on your heart that you feel you need to say before we...
Sure. Just one thing, Dean. It's that a moment ago I was talking about how love, bliss, freedom is our natural state. And anything other than that is directing us to where we've forgotten. And an important last sentence there is that the work that we do supports that process, right? We guide people to a way to lovingly witness wounds, fear, triggers, all of that stuff. And in doing so, harvest the lesson and transmute deep true release across timelines, across lineages, completing cycles for the whole is the work that we do through the traumas and the things that you're experiencing in your life. So the final part of that is, and healing freedom is available to you, period. No matter what, no matter who.
Yeah, it is available to all of us. Thank you.
Yeah, so you know very well.
Here's the thing. I know you are an entrepreneur extraordinaire, and you have your hands in a lot of different pots in the work that you do. We talked about LifeCraft a couple times, or you mentioned it a couple times. And so can you just share with the audience, you know, what LifeCraft does beyond? You know, it sounds like you take people on journeys. You do a bit of personal development and helping guide people through certain pathways of healing. Can you let us know what that might look like? And how do we reach out? What do you have in store for us? How can we get connected?
Sure. Yeah, thank you, Dee. So I'll give a couple of really punchy things here because I know we're running on time. All of the work that we do is about guiding people to this, being fully human. Being fully human is the fullest expression for us as human beings on this planet and this plane. Yeah. And to be fully human, we have to be completely free in unity consciousness. We call it Trinity, which means that we are embodied in the unity of truth, the truth of unity in our system, and able to interface with people in a dualistic world. That's Trinity. In order for us to have that, we have to be embodied. We have to have welcomed our soul into our human vessel.
Yes.
In order for us to have that, we need to have true heart embodiment. We need to be free in the heart. In order for us to be free in the heart, we need to be free of the robot, as we call it, all the matrix programming, whether it's ours or lineage or intergenerational. We need to be free of self-limitations, fears, phobias, traumas, all illusions meant to guide us to true freedom and heart. And so the process is freedom from the robot, freedom from any self-limitations, freedom from ego, and then true embodiment in heart, and then full receipt of soul into body, true embodiment, and then Trinity consciousness, which allows us to be in clarity of and completely free in the expression of our soul gifts, which is being fully human. So all of the work that we do is guiding people towards being fully human. And we've pioneered some really unique, what we call quantum hypnosomatic work, where we guide people into deep states of trance, and then we can perform quantum upgrades, DNA upgrades. We can realign their nervous system and identify, reframe, and release trauma. Do some sound therapy. We do therapeutic psychedelic care. And along the way, we became endeared to the truth that nutrition is very important. When our human body's in revolt, when it's in inflammation, it can be difficult to embody. So there's many ways to get a hold of me, but you know, I think the simplest and the most universal is that nutrition piece. We're not all looking for a big psychedelic experience. We're not all looking to go deeply into our soul yet, but everybody eats food, right? And so, everybody can benefit from eating food that is of true, pure vibration. All of our food has been brought to the table without a neutralization or a distortion of the energy of the earth and animal. And we found profound healing implications for that. So that's really our thing with food, is that we offer many different types of food, but all very, very pure, both chemically and vibrationally.
Beautiful.
Yes. So I think that's the best place to start is to direct people to our food website. It's called Born, because everything that we eat is everything that we produce is born of the earth. And from there, people can reach me and people can expand if they're curious.
Amazing. And I had the privilege of actually having some of your delicious food, by the way.
Right.
And also, my cat got into my pills and ate my bag. Oh,
your bison organs.
Yes, my bison pills. Oh my God. That's a whole other story and topic.
The healthiest cat in the galaxy.
Yeah, I know. She is now. I'm like, thank you for doing that for me.
Anyway. Let me send you some more. I've got more.
Well, I certainly will be coming back for more, because I'm due for another batch anyway. So, you know, I really want to encourage you listeners out there to lean in, check out Lifecraft, check out Born, B-O-R-N, and explore, because there's some real potency here. And, you know, Greg, I got to tell you, I really do believe that the work that you're doing and the businesses that you've created are changing the world and bringing us back to remembrance. That's one thing I want to share with you is, you know, in meeting you in our brief interactions that we had about 6 weeks ago or so, I really felt a deep remembrance in you that invoked remembrance in me. And I think that in itself is medicine for the rest of us. So thank you for being medicine for us. And thank you for seeing that there's opportunity to help the rest of us remember, because that's what I'm after as well, is that deep remembrance of who we are. And so thank you for being a light worker and a champion for that, because we need more of that in this world. Indeed, we do.
Wow. Thank you, Dee. Thank you so much. And it's very mutual.
Thank you. I so appreciate that. And I receive that. And for all you listening, I hope you take so much out of today's story and Greg's share today. Thank you so much for continuing to listen in to this episode and our entire series of podcast on When Spirit Calls. Until next time, be well. Bye, everyone.
So happy you could join us today, and we hope that you found comfort and inspiration with wherever you are at right now. If you feel you received a gift in today's message, please pass that gift along to a loved one by sharing this episode with them. To continue this conversation, please join me at rosehope.ca. And when you do, be sure to access your free gift by signing up for the When Spirit Calls newsletter. I'm looking forward to connecting with you again soon.